We're back here again. The thing called the Old Ragamuffin Show. Who's in the building? Before I shout out, who's in the building? Jazzy Fizzle's in the building. Say yo.
Yo.
Chris Kevin's in the building. Say what up.
What up.
What up. And we are here with this amazing person. It goes by the name of Natalie K. Rush. Hello, darling.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. First of all, what should I call you? Should I call you Natalie? Should I call you Nat? Should I call you Wonder Woman? Should I call you Mrs. Incredible?
I mean, I could just say Madame, but no, we'll go just with Nat.
You
that's
go
with fine.
Nat, yeah?
Yeah, we'll go with Nat. That's fine.
I like Mrs. Incredible. You look a bit like Mrs. Incredible, you know. Have I told you that before?
You have mentioned that before.
Don't you think so? Don't you think so?
Yeah.
Every time I watch that film, we watched Incredibles 2 the other day, and I'm like, Nat, man. She looks just
Do you know
like
my
Nat.
Kids even bought me a key ring of the mom, Incredible. So,
Seriously?
Yeah. But, yeah.
It's what it is. But it's a good thing. It's a compliment, though.
Powerful thighs, but yeah, we'll go with that.
It's a good thing. So the reason why I refer to you as Mrs. Incredible or Wonder Woman is you're one of the strongest people I know. You are. I'm not just saying that. You're one of the strongest people I know. So and I want to tell everybody why. This is the book that Natalie has written. It's called Still Standing. And it's not autobiography, but it's a story of true events that took place and how you come through. So just to give a bit of background before we get into all of the stuff that you're doing now. Before the event, life was ordinary. There was no major dramas. Everything was going fine.
No, everything was going fine. I mean, yeah, I was a divorced mum of two. I've got a 10 and a 6-year-old. I'd got together, though, with my partner, Bobby, who's someone actually I'd known at school and social media wonders, mutual friends. We'd got together about a year after I'd split from my husband. And I was actually pregnant with my third child, which I wasn't expecting. I wasn't expecting to be 40 years of age and suddenly pregnant again. But he hadn't got kids, really wanted them.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, life was good. Nice house, nice area, some coal field, good job, pharmaceutical industry, all that. So maybe looking back, I could say I was in a little bubble.
Okay.
And I think that is a fair way to say it.
Yeah, but it's not that's not a negative, though, because life was going well. So why would you feel like you'd be in this bubble? So, yeah, so life is moving along very neatly and okay. Everything's fine. And then you wake up one morning.
Yeah, I wake up one morning, and the strange thing about the day of what happened, what we're going to talk about in just a moment, is that it was such an ordinary day. So I wake up, it was Friday, the 4th of March, 2016, and it could have been any Friday, any day of the week. And I woke up, I was on leave from my job in the pharmaceutical industry. I was about to start maternity leave, so I'm 8 months pregnant at this point.
Yeah.
And I wake up next to my partner, Bobby, who... You know, usual cuddle in bed, have a chat. He rolls out of bed, gets off ready for work, and I rush around getting my two kids to school. Mm-hmm. So it's standard day, rushing, running late, standard. Natalie time. Natalie time is normal time plus 15.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm too bad. It's only ever a plus 15 minutes, but, you know, it is plus 15. Mm-hmm. And so we dashed into school and I sat down. It was my eldest assembly. So she's 10. So I've got a 10-year-old. So she's what, year five. And I've got my 6-year-old who's sitting in year one. They're at the same school. And it's only a little school. The assembly starts. I've got both my kids there. It's all happy. I'm sat with my ex-husband, who I get on fine with, filming her. And at the end of the assembly, it was all hugs, kisses, embarrassing mom. I remember shouting across to my 6-year-old going, bye, babe, love you, mwah, 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 see you later, which even back then she was cool, so she was kind of like mortally embarrassed, like, eh, mom, yeah, see you later.
There's no point being a parent unless you're embarrassing.
Do you know what? That is actually that is what I always say.
There's no point.
I'm sorry, but it's a tough job, and if you can't embarrass your kids at times or frequently, you know, it's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
100%. That's my goal. Every day I wake up, I'm like, how can I embarrass them today? You know what I mean? All right, Tess?
Listen. Annie does it well, I bet.
Yeah.
Annie. Standard.
Okay, yes, yeah, so the morning's going well.
Good morning going well. And the weird thing is, you know, and it's quite heartbreaking when you look back that there am I kissing them goodbye, waving them goodbye. They're doing the sort of, yeah, mom, you know. The fact was that they didn't know at that point that they weren't going to see mum at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So I'm shouting at them, see you after school, see you after school. Mm-hmm. I'm dashing out, dashing off. And I didn't know that that was going to be the last time I was going to see my girls for at least another week.
Yeah.
And dashed off the gym, went off shopping. And it's when I was shopping, Bobby, my partner, phoned to ask if I'd go to the bank that afternoon.
Okay.
Nothing weird about that. We have money to sort out. The bank was in St. Caulfield Town Centre.
Yeah.
And he was kind of talking about a strange conversational sort of discussion about the fact that he didn't want me to walk into the town centre and that he wanted to pick me up. As you know, I'm a little bit independent mm-hmm. in nature. And even though I was 8 months pregnant, even though I'd just been to the gym and been in hospital the week before.
I was going to pull you up about it. I was like, no, we get to that later. Like, yeah. If I was pregnant and you just come from the gym. Yeah.
And I'd been in hospital about 5 days before with contractions. Right. I was still determined that I could walk in. So that's just the independent way I am.
Yeah.
And but he really insisted that I was to wait at the house for him to come and pick me up.
Yeah.
But I got back and kind of kept checking the time and thinking he's running late. And so I decided to set off.
Yeah.
And not wait for him.
Okay.
And weirdly, when we talk about the event in a moment, it's the fact that all these things, it's like sliding doors moments
yeah.
about what made me leave the house.
Yeah.
And yes, there's the stubbornness, but actually that all plays now into the story.
Yeah.
So I left the house, called Bobby to say I've actually started walking down and didn't know if he'd be a bit annoyed at me for the
yeah.
fact that I'd gone against what he'd said, but he was absolutely fine. He was chatty, saying that he was stuck in traffic, he was on the other side of Birmingham,
okay.
and just apologising that he was running late
okay.
and he should have phoned. And I told him not to worry about it, and the conversation just ended up with just the usual, love you,
yeah.
see you later. And I just remember putting the phone back in my pocket and pressing on into the town centre. Now, I'd got my jacket on, typical me, I'm still wearing the same clothes, so my bump is now sticking right out.
Yeah.
It was raining, I got my umbrella up. And all these sort of things, you think, I've gone down that same road that I was walking down, and I think that was the final place that I was walking down when what happened.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, if events had been any different, that would have been the last place
yeah.
that I'd been. That would have been the last phone call I ever made
yeah,
and
yeah.
stuff like that. So I get to the town centre, well, near the town centre. Now, for people who don't know, Sutton Town Centre's got this big church that sits at the top of it
yeah.
called Holy Trinity Church. And behind the church is quite a nice, wide, tree-lined alley.
Yeah.
And it goes quite a steep downhill. And it goes into this dead-end road that comes up from the ring road. So literally opposite the end of it is the town centre. So
you're in town,
really,
basically.
Really
it's not,
close.
It's not secluded. Or
no, gosh, no. And when I say alleyway, you know,
it's big, isn't it?
It's by a churchyard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's got trees lining it. And,
yeah.
and there's people going up and down there. People use it frequently
yeah.
to get up and down from the town centre. The strange thing is this place, this alleyway, it's called Trinity Hill. And it's not somewhere I've ever liked.
Okay.
20 years before what happened to me, a girl had actually been murdered
okay.
on that hill. And it was a really awful awful event. It was a girl, 17-year-old called Nicola Dixon.
Okay.
And it was massive news in Sutton. Nothing
yeah.
like that had ever happened before.
Yeah.
She was a schoolgirl from a local school, and they built a memorial to her at
okay.
the top of the hill.
Right.
So here I am, top of Trinity Hill, umbrella up, bump sticking out, getting wet. And I'm thinking, do I go down there? Never
yeah.
gone down on my own before. Always gone down with people, but just there's just an air about it. Never liked it.
Okay.
Looking at her memorial, which always reminded me
yeah,
of what
yeah.
happened.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking and having the thought process, you know, like, Natalie, it was like coming up 3:10 in the afternoon, 3:10, town centre's ahead, there's people coming up and down the hill. Stop
just,
being
just
so stupid.
Yeah,
for, you know,
it, yeah.
for God's sake, just push on, woman. You're getting wet, the bump's getting wet.
Yeah.
So I start making my way down Trinity Hill and start making my way down the tree-lined alley. And that's when I suddenly heard these footsteps
right.
and they're running and they're coming quite fast. And it's literally like feet scuffing along. So it's actually somebody in trainers. So you could hear that sort of scuff of
okay.
the trainers. And I remember glancing over my shoulder and seeing this guy. He's got hoodie on, and his hood is right up, and his head's down. He's quite scruffily dressed, and he's running with his hands sort of down by his pockets, and he's sort of running along. And I don't know why I felt, my sixth sense, whatever it is, that he was running towards me. Okay. And I can't tell you why I felt that, because, you know, he could have been running to the town centre, he could have been late for something, whatever. But I decided I needed to speed up, because I felt that if I could get out to the dead end road that it went out into, there were cars parked up, there's a guy walking up the hill, and I thought, if I can just get there, I'll be safe. Yeah. This guy, if he is running after me, he ain't going to jump me when I get out into the open.
So and he was uncomfortable anyway, because you said he didn't really like walking down.
I didn't like it. And I think that's the thing, you know, you sort of got it in your head, and you are, you're doing all this self-talk, you know, self-talk thinking, is this just me being stupid? Yeah. You know, is it because I've spooked myself out? Yeah. And I remember I got out and I was like, phew. I remember literally thinking, oh. But then I felt that he was behind me.
Okay.
And we are now out to set the scene. I'm on the pavement. There's a dead end road, but it's all cobbled, and you could walk down the road as easily as you walk down the pavement.
Okay.
And I suddenly realised this guy is right behind me.
Okay.
And it's that horrible sensation.
Oh, sorry, he was on the pavement.
So I'm on the pavement now. So he
if he wasn't, so this is how you know he's behind you, because he's on the pavement behind
you. He's behind me, and I can almost feel him. I can hear him.
Yeah.
And in my head, I'm thinking, why isn't he just walking around me?
Why isn't he just going down the road?
Because he could just go down the road.
Yeah.
You know, there's no cars coming up here. Yeah. He could go down the road. And your heart starts pounding and all sorts of things going through your head and all sorts of swear words clearly going on. And I remember stepping to one side almost to make it clear, you know, when you do that whole,
just go past me.
Yeah. You know, I don't want you behind me. I feel uncomfortable. Just go past. So I stepped clearly to the left-hand side. And literally, as I made that move, I'll never forget this absolute thud as he jumped on me from behind. So he full force jumped on me and pulled me backwards. So his arm came across me like this, grabbed hold of my chest and pulled me backwards into him.
Wow.
And as he pulled me backwards into him, I'm there thinking, oh God, I'm being mugged.
Yeah.
Because my handbag's on this side, I'm 8 months pregnant, I've just come down an alleyway, I probably look a vulnerable female. And so I'm screaming at him to let me go. My bag's on that side and I'm trying to break free of him, sort of almost go, just have the bag, you know. So I'm screaming, get off me. And as I'm trying to pull free from him, because I can't really see him because he's got me, he's behind me in effect. So he sort of pulled me to his chest and stomach. And then literally out the corner of my eye, in his right hand, I'll never forget, he pulled a 12-inch kitchen carving knife. I don't even know where he pulled it from. I just remember just looking up and there's his arm and there's this blade. And you're thinking, whoa, you don't need to be, you know, you can have my bag, you can have whatever. And something I don't actually normally share is, I think I've written about it but I didn't share it, is at this point in your head you're trying to make sense. You're trying to make sense of it. So you're thinking, right, is this a mugging?
Yeah.
Clearly a mugging. Okay, he's pulled a knife now. I don't need to have the knife. He can have my bag.
Yeah.
But weirdly, because his arm was across me.
Yeah.
I always remember his arm cupped underneath my chest. So he's actually got my right breast in his hand.
Yeah.
So then my head's thinking, is this a sexual attack?
Yeah.
Is this somebody who's got some strange fetish for a pregnant woman? And, you know, and then there's this fear of, oh, my God, this is a sexual attack. But before my brain could process any other reasons of what the heck was going on, he literally brought the knife straight down and stabbed me straight in the centre of my chest. So he's holding on to me and the knife is coming down. Now, what I always explain, I talk to young people now about reality of stabbings and knife crime, you know, I'm sure we'll speak about later. But I remember seeing the knife, I remember seeing the blade, I remember it coming down. I always remember the sharp pain, and it was a really sharp, burning pain as it went through into my ribs. But my head was still in such denial that it could be happening. I remember I actually had to look down. I remember looking down, almost to double check, hold on, my top is ripped, I am bleeding.
Yeah.
And then that long last.
It like,
yeah, it's like my head just wouldn't accept that I was being stabbed. And until I looked physically myself,
yeah,
and I saw that I was actually bleeding, my top's all ripped, that it suddenly hit me, oh my God, I am actually being stabbed here. And now my head's completely out of control because I'm 8 months pregnant, I've got a bump to protect, and for some reason someone's stabbing me in the chest with this huge knife.
Yeah.
So I'm screaming. I'm screaming to a guy that I saw walking up the hill. And this guy I now know is called Johnny. At the time, I didn't know him, obviously, at all. And I'm screaming to him, help me, please help me. Now, this poor guy, he's minding his own business.
Yeah.
He's coming home. His story is he's coming home from work, got his earphones in, walking up Trinity Hill, completely oblivious, like any of this would be. And he said that he looked up the hill. And when he looked up, he said he saw the attacker jumping on me.
Right.
And he thought we were mates messing about. He says, at first, I saw this guy jump on you and I thought you were just mates. You know, he's like surprising you. He said, but then I looked at your face and he said, I've never seen anyone's face contort with fear as much as yours did.
Yeah.
And he said, the look of pure fear on your face. He said, and then I saw the knife. And then his head was spinning, thinking, well, what do I do? Do I run for help? Do I shout for help? Do I call the police? Do I run and help her directly? And luckily for me, he ran. And came to my aid. He ran. What I didn't know is there was a guy walking down the hill behind the attacker who also came running, a guy called Tony.
Yeah.
Now, Tony jumped on the attacker's back.
Yeah.
Johnny is pulling at the attacker's arm, and they're pulling him down to the pavement. The problem is the attacker has got hold of me, and he drags me down. So now there's four of us, bang, on the pavement, sprawled out, but the attacker's got me pinned. And what I couldn't understand is the attacker is still incessantly stabbing at me.
He's still stabbing at you at this time.
So these guys are grappling with him.
Yeah.
But it hasn't stopped him. He's still, literally the blows were just incessant. And I'm screaming at him while this knife's coming at me. I'm screaming at him, why me? And why me? What have I done to you?
Yeah.
It's weird. I never knew I'd actually said that until I met Tony, the guy who'd second guy to intervene. I said to Tony, I remember thinking during the attack, why me? And he said, you were screaming it. He said, you were actually shouting at the attacker, why me? What have I done to you? Why me? Because even still, my head's still trying to do this processing but what is this? Because I think, well, I've not annoyed anyone. I don't understand. You know, is this a psychiatric patient who's somehow escaped? You know, you sort of hear occasionally where there's maybe a patient with schizophrenia who's somehow lost it. And
you're just trying to basically make sense of
it. Yeah. Rich, while you're halfway through a multiple stabbing, might not be the time to try and make sense of it, I'll be honest.
I was going to say, who knows, but you know what will go through
your mind. Yeah, and that's the thing. And I think, weirdly, I think if you're in any major traumatic situation, you're trying to normalize all the time.
Yeah.
You're just trying to normalize. And that's what I was doing. I was trying to put a rationale in because it was almost just trying to diminish the horror. Let's try and make this as normal.
Yeah.
And it wasn't normal, obviously. So they're grappling with him. And luckily, Tony manages to grab his arm that's got the knife, the attacker's arm, and he pins the attacker's arm backwards just to stop the knife blowing on me anymore.
Yeah.
And the attacker actually let go of me to get his own arm back. And I suddenly realise that I'm free.
Yeah.
I get to my feet. I'm really wobbly. I don't know how I get to my feet because I look down and I'm totally pouring with blood at this point.
Yeah.
The knife's gone through the side of my wrist. I remember cradling my bump and looking and realising that I can't feel my hand properly.
Yeah.
And I start stumbling down Trinity Hill.
Yeah.
And it's like a horror movie because I'm looking down Trinity Hill as I'm stumbling down the hill and I can see people in the McDonald's and I can see people going in and out of McDonald's and I'm trying to shout for help but can't shout loud enough. There's people at the bus stops, there are people literally just going about normal Friday afternoon shopping and they've literally no idea that a couple of hundred yards away from them there's this horrific attack happening.
Mm.
I can't shout loud enough.
Yeah.
I'm trying to sort of call for help. But it's like nobody can hear me.
Yeah.
And I spot this car park that's halfway down Trinity Hill on the left. And there's a Baptist church there. And I could see that there's a meeting room. And there are all these cars outside. And I thought, well, there must be people in there. So if I can get to there, I can get help. But as I got closer, I felt my legs starting to go. So the adrenaline that got me to my feet in the first place was clearly dropping off quickly. The blood loss was getting so huge, and I'm 8 months pregnant anyway. And the next thing I know is that smack, I went face first on the pavement. I know from talking to Johnny, the first guy who helped me, he said that they're all struggling on the pavement. They suddenly realised I'd gone. And they're sort of like, where's she gone? Where is she? And he said, I looked down Trinity Hill. He said, and you were face first on the pavement, not moving. He said, and I was convinced you were dead. He said, I was sure. I thought she's died. She's face down.
I can understand that.
Yeah, because, you know, they'd known how many blows I'd taken already. But being stubborn, which is always a good thing, after you start, I found out, very good thing. I will tell everyone that. It's a good thing that I am stubborn.
Yeah, go on.
I came round.
I'll give you that one.
Exactly. I'm glad that's been recorded. And I came round and I start crawling to this brick pillar. So by the car park was this brick pillar which got the gate.
So you came round, so you was out. Oh, obviously, when you went down.
I completely passed out. Yeah. What I must have done is I came round and apparently I then crawled.
Okay.
Partly I remember, part, to be honest, is what other people have told me.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to know which is my first-hand memory
or what
someone told me. Because the next thing I know is I'm propped on the pavement against this pillar, slumped, looking back up the hill, feeling a sense of guilt because I'd left these two guys who come to help me, and then I've gone and legged it and left them with the attacker. So there was a sense of guilt. And but I look back up the hill, and to my absolute horror, there's only two guys on the pavement because the attacker has now got up and he's now walking towards me.
Shit.
So I'm there with my... I remember literally thinking, nah, move, move, move. You've got to get up. Get the hell out of here. You know, you've got to move. And my legs wouldn't move. I just could not. I had no energy to get up. And all I could do, this guy's walking towards me, and it's literally like a horror scene. You know, he's a guy with a knife in his hand walking towards me. And the best that I could do is I'm holding my bump as best I can. I'm slumped on the pavement, so my bottom's right on the cold, wet pavement. I'm putting my arm up to protect myself. So it's like putting my arm up as best I can. And he pulled up, and he sort of walked in front of me. I remember he walked down the hill and he squatted down. So he's now squat down right in front of me. And he held the knife into my face. So I got a little scar by my nose, and he held the blade. And with his free hand, he starts punching me repeatedly. Now, at the time, I didn't know he was punching me. I actually thought I was still being stabbed, because when you get stabbed repeatedly, the feeling is actually the same.
It's weird.
It's like you're being punched.
Okay.
So I thought he was actually stabbing me in the face, but he was punching me, apparently. He punched me, knocked me out. I come round. Now, how squeamish are you? How squeamish is he? How far can I go with detail?
You reckon, Chris?
Okay. So I come round and I'm now slumped to one side, and he's pinned my arm down on the pavement, and he's got the broken blade of the knife, and he held it to my wrist. And as you see, is that he then traced the blade through my wrist and into my palm. And there's nothing I can do. He's pinned my arm down and he's cutting through my wrist while I watch him do it. And he went straight through the main artery. So the next thing I see is all, obviously, the blood come out.
He's aiming for that then?
Yeah. It was a clear, accurate cut. And the hospital said he was bang on. And actually, I don't have a pulse properly on that side anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So joking aside, because I have a very cold hand constantly, if you feel my hand now, it's stone cold, because I don't have a good blood supply. My brother-in-law, who's a doctor, said...
It is really cold.
I told you it's cold. We is a grey, dead hand. But my brother-in-law recently, his doctor said, why is your hand so cold? And he felt for my pulse there. So although they repaired the artery, because he literally went straight through the artery there.
Yeah.
It's so badly damaged that the pulse is very, very weak. So I do always have this fear that should I ever pass out in public, that if someone tries to take my
pulse...
I'm thinking a tattoo might be a good idea.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Try the other one.
Don't use this one.
Big red cross.
Doesn't work.
Not functioning. I don't want it that someone's jumping on my chest or something. Yeah, like, no, I'm alive.
It's not a bad idea, you know.
I'm alive. There is just no pulse there.
Yeah.
So he'd done that, and then he'd got this knife, and he actually turned it to my baby bump next. So the next thing I know is he's stabbing me straight in the stomach.
You know,
which...
I've heard this, sorry to interrupt you, yeah? I've heard this story a few times, and I read the book, obviously, like when he was writing the book and stuff like that. And still, even now when you're telling me this now, I'm just still like, I can't believe this. That I just, you know what I mean? It's still, every time I've heard it, and up to now, it still pisses me off. And it's just madness, isn't it?
Yeah. Because to turn it, because to turn it on the bump was just, the only fortunate thing at this point was that the blade was broken, so at least it was a shorter blade rather than the long blade. Okay. I know that sounds a strange thing to say, but...
No, but it makes sense.
It made sense that, you know, because when he cut through my wrist, it was a broken... The blade was found next to me broken, apparently, and it was all bent from the force that he'd used it. But at this point, he's now using a broken blade. He stabbed me in the stomach repeatedly with quite a lot of force, and I'm screaming at him, please, you know, not the baby. Don't kill me. I'm a mom already. And I remember still trying to do this reasoning with him, trying to make myself a real person, saying, I'm a mom already. Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. Please, that's my baby. Don't kill my baby. The next thing I know is I've got a big scarf on. It's a cold day in March, and luckily I got this big scarf, and I could feel him pulling at my scarf, and I felt the blade go against my throat. Now, at this point, another member of the public is now kicking at him. So apparently there was a member of the public literally putting the boot in. So as he had the knife there, he got knocked off me. So it sort of felt it there, and then it got knocked off.
Okay.
He then positioned himself behind me. There are photos of it. I don't think I've even shown you ever the photos.
I didn't want to look.
There were photos taken by a passerby or somebody who'd seen an attack. And he's standing behind me, and he pulls it down. He's got the knife literally on my throat. And I remember thinking, this is it.
Yeah.
This is it, because if he does this, that's it. I can't survive that. And then within a second, all of a sudden, I find myself lying on the pavement sideways, and he's somewhere across in the car park. What had happened is an 18-year-old lad called Callum had been standing at the bus stops on his way home, young lad. He'd heard the shouts for help.
Yeah.
So the two guys that had been holding the attacker started shouting for help. And a man's voice shouting for help is a really powerful thing. It attracts attention even more. If you've got a deep voice shouting help, people do look.
Yeah.
I don't know what made Callum out. If everybody in Sutton, Callum ran across the ring road. He ran up Trinity Hill. He rounded the corner and he said he saw the attacker over me. He saw me covered in blood. He had no idea the attacker had a knife. And all he did was he grabbed him and rugby tackled him off me and threw him into the car park. And then unbelievably, the attacker got up for a third time and comes at me again. And there's photos. There's a photo in the press that was released of the attacker drawing the whole thing, and that is actually of him coming at me for a third time.
Okay.
Again, walking towards me, very controlled, quite spooky. You know, this is not somebody running at me, very controlled. Yeah. And as he was standing over me with a knife, like I say, I kind of upset the big man upstairs because somebody's watching over me, and I've all sorts of theories about people watching over me, but three police officers happened to be on foot patrol in Sutton Town Centre. They heard the shouts for help. They came running up the hill behind Callum. They came with their batons drawn. They said they rounded the corner. He was over me with the knife. And the second he saw the police, he threw the knife down. Which, again, interesting thing, because this attacker will later claim that he'd temporarily lost his mind. But this is somebody who's acting in a very...
You know exactly what he's doing.
Very controlled way, yeah.
I think you lost your mind when you're aiming for the archery.
No,
I think your mind when you're pulling the scarf down, trying to get to your juggler.
Yeah. So the whole attack, start to finish, it was 9 minutes, which is a long, long time. You know, you think about, heaven forbid, think back to the atrocity of London Bridge, the London Bridge terror attack. That was 8 minutes, they said, from start to finish. Because I remember that wasn't long after my attack. And I was thinking, my God, I had 9 minutes of this one man against me. I'm 8 months pregnant. And it was just, it was like it was never going to end.
Yeah.
And if the police hadn't been there, to be honest, it probably would have ended with me being in a body bag.
To be fair, if all three of them wasn't there, if it wasn't, let's say their names again. John.
So it's Johnny, John Mitchell.
Yeah.
Tony Smith.
Yeah.
And then Callum Gibson. Yeah. And Callum.
If those three weren't there as well, because they intervened at
really they're incredible.
Times, like, you know?
Incredible. Incredible people. And so the police are there. They've arrested the attacker. They've got him pinned to the pavement. But then they've got me to deal with. So they're looking at me. I'm absolutely covered in blood. Apparently it was hair up in my hair, over my face. I'm, you know, obviously arteries open. So they start tourniqueting my arm. They're pressing on my chest. And this goes back, squeamish alert. If you're squeamish, just be aware mm-hmm. what I'm going to say. Yeah. I'll never forget the police officer saying, Natalie, I'm going to take your hand and I'm going to guide it to your bump, but I don't want you to look down. But obviously,
first thing you do.
Yeah. It's like someone saying, don't look over there. And you go,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What? So she guided it down and obviously my eyes followed my hand and it was met with quite a sponginess on the top of my bump. And I remember going, oh, God, what's that? What's that? And the police officer, I never forget saying to me, it's your intestine, Natalie. We need you to keep your hand over your intestines. They've come out and you need to hold them until the ambulance gets here. And to think that you're there, you've got someone telling you your intestine has come out, you're holding it yourself, you've got people, and it's just this, it's like all this noise going on around me.
Yeah.
And it started to hit me that actually I wasn't out of the woods, because when the attack finished, I thought, oh gosh, I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Then it suddenly hit me, no, this is really serious. I'm actually really, really in a bad way.
Yeah.
They airlifted me out of Sutton Town Centre. The air ambulance came in. They immediately mobilised an air ambulance for me, knowing how serious it was. When they landed, they thought I was going to be dead.
Yeah.
They were convinced my blood pressure was only just above what would sustain life. I was 8 months pregnant, so they thought that she's going to be in cardiac arrest. They came into the back of the ambulance, and I laughed because they came in, and they've since said to me, we're there thinking, right, we're going to have to resuscitate it, we're going to have to deliver this baby, we're going to have to do all this. And you sort of like opened your eyes and went, all right. It's like, oh my God, she's still talking.
Yeah.
As you know, not a lot stops me. And it was. But they then realised, they sort of assessed me and they said, you were our worst nightmare. You're 8 months pregnant. We don't like airlifting pregnant people, they said. You've got multiple stab wounds to the chest, to the abdomen. Your main artery's been cut open.
How many stab wounds?
24. So I had 24 stab wounds. I had 11 in my chest alone.
Yeah.
They had then gone into my stomach, down my side. So my right lung had fully collapsed.
Yeah.
He'd gone through the main artery of my wrist. He'd gone through the main muscle here in my arm. A lot of my injuries. So the knife had actually hit, in summary, the knife had hit the outside part of my heart. It hit my right lung, which had fully collapsed. He lacerated my diaphragm in two places.
Yeah.
He went through my liver.
Yeah.
He did go through the uterus, carrying the baby, and he'd gone through the main artery. So any one of those, as the hospital said, should have killed me.
Yeah.
You know, if your liver's hit, you can bleed out very quickly. Yeah. Everything should have been. And so they're there fully expecting me to be as good as dead, and I'm actually still
and
conscious.
Like, all right.
All right. Just like that bleary-eyed Natalie Brummy, dulcet tones coming at them. So they, so they got me into the air ambulance straight away. They didn't put chest drain in. I was on one lung, and they airlifted me. And it was an 8-minute airlift from Sutton Town Centre to the QE Hospital, which, for people who don't know, it's on the other side of the Birmingham City Centre.
Yeah.
Probably about on blue lights, 25 minutes.
Well, eight minutes in a helicopter is quite far.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you can
especially across a city, you know what I mean? That's a long drive, isn't it? You know?
Well, the thing is, it's Friday afternoon. We're talking, you know, quarter to four at this point or whatever, 10 to 4. So, you know, it was bad. They reckon that when we landed, I had less than 5 minutes left to live. So the point we took off, I probably only had less than quarter of an hour left of living. So if I'd gone in a land ambulance, the facts of the matter are I would have died in the back of a land ambulance halfway across Birmingham.
Yeah.
Depressingly, probably on the Aston Expressway somewhere near Spaghetti Junction.
Yeah.
which is a bloody depressing place to think about dying. If I'm telling you,
no, it's great, but Spaghetti Junction.
No, Spaghetti Junction. It wasn't what you choose to do. Yeah,
go,
I mean, you know, we can't generally choose these things, but Spaghetti Junction wasn't. Yeah, pretty low down on my list of places I'd want to die. But so they rushed me to theatre, and I was in theatre for 5 hours. And I always remember when they got to the hospital, a trauma doctor. The brilliant thing of the QE is it's a military hospital, so they deal with all the people coming back from Afghan and stuff like that. They are shit hot. The doctors there, they are amazing. And you've got a trauma doctor receiving me, who's a military doctor as well, so he's used to people being in bits and pieces. And I remember him always saying to me, Natalie, we're going to put you to sleep now, but you're not going to come around till at least tomorrow or the day after. We're going to keep you asleep for a while. And I remember just nodding, because I couldn't breathe properly at this point. And I remember just thinking, just put me to sleep.
Yeah.
Because I've had enough. I couldn't fight.
I'd be glad for the sleep. I was. Yeah, please, let me go to sleep, please.
I was, and that's it. I think at that point, I was so exhausted that I just thought, I just someone take over. I almost didn't care at that point what happened. Yeah. You know, I'd fought to stay alive the whole time in the air ambulance. All I could think about was my two older daughters. And I was so scared that I would die and they'd be left without their mum, especially being a single mum, I think, as well. And yes, my ex-husband was around on the scene, but I was still the person they lived with. And I think genuinely that's what helped keep me alive, because I was so scared. So I fought all the way in the air ambulance, focus, stay alive. And by the time I got to the hospital, I was... I've had it now. I've had it.
For want of a better word.
Yeah, but it was.
Like knackered.
I was. Yeah, fully.
It's crazy. So, like I said, I've heard this story like many times, you know what I mean? And still every time it's just crazy. So... Fast forward just a little bit.
Yeah.
You survived. Baby survived.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
The
the doctors couldn't believe that even.
No. So the first thing I was told when I came around was that I had a daughter. They delivered her in theatre. Everyone presumed her to be dead.
Yes.
And to be fair, she was pale. She was floppy. She wasn't breathing. They had to resuscitate her. It took over 5 minutes before they brought her round. They didn't think they were going to get her back. And I don't know if you knew, it did took a long time to get a little one back.
I knew that they resuscitated. I didn't know it took that long though.
Yeah, it took about 5 or 6 attempts.
Did you die?
And things. As far as I'm aware, I don't think I did, but I've never asked whether my heart ever stopped. Probably a critical question, or maybe I assume that they'd tell me. Will they? Will they tell me?
I don't know.
I would have
thought they would have told you, but maybe they were just too amazed that you hadn't, that you were still there.
I know that it was so touch and go when we got to the hospital. And I was still conscious when we got to the hospital. So, I don't know, because I know that they had to work on me for quite some time first.
Yeah. And for him to say that he's going to put you to sleep. Then
I remember talking to him, but I know in theatre it was bad.
Yeah.
It was really bad. I've got a scar all the way from there, all the way down, because they had to completely open me up, one, to get the baby out, but also to repair me. So I'm left quite heavily scarred, obviously across my body. So I come around, they tell me she survived, and she did incur damage to her brain.
Yeah.
That is a fact. She was starved of oxygen.
Yeah.
But as you know, you've met my littlest one. She's a little fighter. She's a feisty mommy's little
girl. She's your daughter,
girl.
I'll tell you that.
She's my little bear, as
she's
I call
strong.
Her. But
she's strong. She's very, very strong.
She's a really strong girl, very funny. And she's so far defied every single odd.
Yeah.
You know, I was told at one point she could be cerebral palsy, she could be this, she could be that. No. She starts school later this year, so we'll know if there's some learning difficulties, which there might be. But I tell you what, she knows the days of the week. She can count up to like 30.
Yeah, yeah.
The kids...
There's no great sign of loss.
No, she had a speech delay, but that's even that she's catching up on.
Okay.
And she's turning into a mom and talks all the time.
Yeah.
And then I guess the devastating part for those who don't know my story was that I had this brilliant news. So I'm sort of lying there, sort of bleary, in and out of consciousness, like, my God, I've actually got a daughter, she's alive. To then be on, I realise I'm on my own.
Yeah.
that Bobby's not there, my mum's not there, my sisters aren't there, but there's these police officers standing waiting to talk to me.
Yes.
So you're in critical care, you're trying to take in everything, and you're completely alone. And these police officers come up and say, Natalie, we've got to talk to you, I'm afraid. And they'd been waiting for a long time for me to come around enough. And they asked me what I remembered about the attack, and I talked to them and told them the bits and pieces. And then they broke the news to me that the person they had under arrest at Sutton Police Station, the person they'd arrested at the scene, and being charged with my attempted murder of a baby, was actually Bobby, my partner, who had left home as normal, who I'd been on the phone to on my way down, whose final words were, I love you, who'd shown all this concern about me, had never been violent. I'd known 25 years, never been violent. Like, literally, people go, oh, but it must have been signs. No, nothing.
Even I asked you that. I remember asking you, so in the morning then, was there an argument? Did you have an argument the night before or whatever? There was nothing.
No, and even that morning, and it's quite sick, really, looking back, that morning, he even tried it on when he pulled me to him in bed, and I was like, no, get off me. And he goes, yeah, but tonight, when we get back, get the girls to bed early, and you and I will have an early night. Weird. Yet he knew that afternoon he was going to murder me. Because as it came out, he'd had the knife and the clothes. He was in disguise. So for people wondering, well, why did she not know it was him? He had four tops on. Under his outer layer, he had a rucksack, which had spare clothes, spare shoes. He had two pairs of trousers on. He had scruffy trainers that I'd never seen before. These trainers, not a clue. I've seen photos of them since they were ones he got from his mum's house, I think. He got two pairs of gloves. He had latex gloves with gardening gloves over the top. And he'd padded himself up so much, I didn't recognise him. He got his hood right over his head.
So when the police turn around and say to you, we've got somebody in custody, we've got the attacker, and we need to inform you it's your partner.
Mm.
Like, how do you receive that news? How did you receive that news?
Just broke.
Yeah, of course.
I absolutely broke. I'll be totally honest. I remember lying there, and I remember tears just streaming. God, I get upset thinking about it. I don't normally get upset. I talk about this all the time.
Yeah.
Gosh, they're in curveball at me yet. But I just remember crying because I've got the memories of this horrific attack. I don't know how my little one, because at this point they didn't know if she was going to survive.
Yeah.
So although she had survived being delivered, she was in a coma.
Yeah.
They were having to keep her body cool and things to preserve her brain activity. And at the same time, I'm taking the person who's done this is the very person that I trusted and loved and everything else. You know, we'd been talking about marriage. We were doing our house up together, you know.
Well, you'd already said we already established at the beginning life was going pretty well and stuff like that. You're right, yeah?
Yeah. No, it's just weird. Sometimes things will catch me as a curveball. Yeah. But, it fell apart. It's the only way I put it. It fell apart and went into the biggest, deepest black hole that you could imagine.
Yeah.
And it then turned into a circus of absolute hell because you've got reporters wanting to get into the hospital. You've got reporters turning up at my mum's house. My family are being questioned by the police.
Good old newspapers, you know, being delicate as usual.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
The attack happened on the Friday. I'd come out of the coma on the Saturday because they kept me in the coma just till the Saturday morning. By the Monday, they were releasing photos of me, and across every newspaper were photos of me they'd taken off Facebook. And I remember my ex-husband had taken my kids into Sainsbury's local just to get some shopping. And he walked in and he said, there's just a sea of newspapers with your face on every paper saying, first photo of a woman stabbed. And for my kids, that was really hard because that's mum.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That's mum. So, and that's the thing. That's the thing with, you know, when I talk about knife crime now in my life, it's the ripple effect is huge. You know, there was me who got affected, but it wasn't just me. The trauma that day, the trauma for my mum, my sisters, my daughters, especially my daughters, even my ex-husband, you know, everybody
innit? Yeah.
Everybody was affected. And friends of mine who were WhatsApping me, phoning me, checking Facebook. Because, you know, the news report came out quite quickly. There's a 40-year-old woman who's been stabbed in Sutton Town Centre. So all my friends are there thinking, just going to text Nat. It can't be Nat. Can't be Nat. It
well,
must
worse
be someone
as well,
else.
It's probably saying pregnant as well. Sort
yeah.
Of thing. So then that's
it's like, well, she's 40-year-old pregnant, Sutton.
Oh, no, that sounds like,
that does
yeah.
narrow it down. Yeah. But there must be other 40-year-olds pregnant. And for one of my friends, a friend Annabelle, she said it was only when BBC News were filming on the scene, so you got the forensics with all their white suits, and BBC News scanned up the hill, and my handbag was on the pavement.
Oh, crap.
So I got quite a distinct, it's this orange leather handbag, which I'll be honest, my mate hated. She hated the handbag. She hated it before, so
she knew
it. Cause
she so
hated,
well, like,
yeah, she's like,
that flipping handbag.
She goes, I hate that bloody handbag. And she said she stood there watching the news, couldn't get hold of me, and she said, and they scanned up, panned up the hill, and she said, and there was your bag.
Oh, I feel sick.
And she said, literally, she went cold, and she turned to her son who was stood next to her, and she went, it's Nat. It's Nat, because that's Nat's bag.
I'm just thinking, like, being in that position there, like, I literally, I'd from it.
And I think that was it, and that was the reality. And a friend of mine turned up at the house to check on me because they couldn't get hold of me. A good friend of mine, Wayne, he came round. His wife had phoned him in quite a panic, going, have you heard the news? Have you spoken to Nat? It's not Nat, is it? And his wife kept going on to him, can you just go and check? Just go and check on her. So he drove past my house and popped in, and the police arrived at the house while he was checking, knocking the door. They're obviously going to him.
Like, who are you?
Yeah.
He's like, what a bloody hell are you?
My poor mate's there going, I've got nothing to do
and
with
like,
this.
And he's like, no, what's going on? And they're like, no,
yeah,
the hell are you?
Exactly. And he's going, please don't tell me that, you know, he goes, it can't be the person, that woman who got in attacked in Sutton, that's not Natalie, is it? And they said, yeah. It is. We can't tell you any more than that, but it is. And obviously then the starts to go out, friends are hearing about it, but nobody knew it was Bobby. So everyone's then going, well, who's attacked her? So then they're all texting Bobby saying, well, how's Natalie? Is she okay?
Yeah.
And trying to get updates, not realising that he was the man under arrest for it. So, it's all so many people affected. But you see it with knife crime all the time, you know. My heart breaks when you hear of yet another teenager. I think, you know, every week we hear of a teenager who's been stabbed. And you think, what? There's a young lad, I think 2 years after me, a young lad got stabbed, say young, 16, 17-year-old lad, Ozell, in Sutton Town Centre, not far from where I was stabbed, and he died.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking. I think he received a single stab wound in his chest that hit his heart.
Yeah.
And you know, and you think about his parents, and I believe, you know, his dad was phoned while he was driving. And you just think, regardless of when his parents were informed, can you imagine the impact as a parent, you know, and then their friends. And I met Ozell's friends. I went and laid flowers where Ozell got stabbed, and his friends were there. And these are like young lads, and they stood there and they looked broken.
Mm-hmm.
And you realise the impact it's had on them. And this is the thing. It's this ripple effect. There's so many people that get affected. One action and so many people.
Yeah. We've got so much to talk about, you know. And so that's the story anyway. You know what I mean? It's not easy. You lot right, yeah? it's not easy, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's crazy. But anyway, I just talking about the events, though, I'm just going to show you the book again. I recommend this book, yeah? It's an amazing read. You know what I mean? Just to know that you're still standing. I love the title as well. You know what I mean? Did I come with that title?
You what, sorry?
Did I come with that title? I'm joking.
Wow. I'm not going to say, actually, I was going to say a phrase and I know you don't like, so
I'm not going
to say.
Oh, don't you dare.
You knew. You knew. Did you know? I began with the first letter and then I was like, no, he doesn't.
No. So anyway, so moving on. When I say we've got lots of things to talk about, obviously it still stems from that, you know. So they've got him in custody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, you can't get no more premeditated than this. Someone's called you. He's called you. He said to you to come and meet me. Furthermore, before I go down that road there, I think it's actually a great thing that you were stubborn and you left the house.
Yeah.
And I never realised this before, But if you'd have stayed in the house, would he have done it in the house?
The police actually reckon that I potentially, and this is something I will live and dine out on forever, about the fact that my stubbornness saved my life. So whenever I'm being stubborn and people complain about it, I can say, yeah, but it saved my life. The police reckon that he was actually, potentially an idea was that he would come to the house, not necessarily do it at the house, maybe take me somewhere. Because we would go for walks in Sutton Park, Bobby and I. You know, it'd be quite usual that we'd go. He'd say, well, let's go to the park. Let's go and get this nice little coffee place in Sutton Park. And Sutton Park is a vast park, loads of woodland. And they reckon he probably would have taken me off somewhere, potentially killed me, dumped my body. And it would have been one of those horrific stories where you hear a dog walker or runner has found body in the park or wherever. They think that the fact that I left the house when I did saved my life.
Without
because I actually put myself into a public place.
Without a doubt.
And again, that's why I say about the sliding doors moment, that decision to leave the house probably saved me.
Yeah.
If I'd waited for him like he wanted me to.
Yeah, I think you would have been a complete
Yeah, I would have had no one. I'd have had no one to come and help me. And if I didn't have those, as you say quite rightly, if Johnny, Tony, Callum hadn't come to help me, I'd be dead. You know, it's just a fact, I'd be dead. And and the other weird moment, because people sort of say, well, you're on the phone to him. So he wasn't stuck in traffic. What's come out since is he was actually in Sutton Town Centre when I made that phone call. He was parked up. He'd gone and just bought his lunch from Marks and Spencer's, like you do before you go and murder someone. You must get your energy up. So he'd gone and bought lunch, been caught on the camera, paid with his card,
yeah.
But he'd very much put a footprint there that he was in Sutton. So he was in normal clothes at this point,
yeah.
Picked up, he went and used the cash point. So again, a footprint that he was there. The plan probably was he'd left work, he needed an alibi to where he was. So he went, I believe, to Sutton Town Centre, and then what he was going to do was come sneak out the town centre because he was in a car park that didn't have CCTV, drive, pick me up, do it, and probably then return to the centre.
And still be in the centre.
I'd asked my mum to collect the girls because we were meeting at 3:30 at the bank. So he got this alibi that he was meeting me at the bank. So he could have stood at Barclays Bank going,
Where is she?
I followed his plan because I've then left. So he's now in this dilemma of, crap, she's left. What am I going to do? And I think he'd so built himself up he was going to do it that day. He just got into disguise. He apparently got changed in the car park, and he then just walked up. Whether we both had iPhones, he'd been messing with my iPhone the night before because he'd said that his phone was, I can't remember, he said, oh, my phone's in the kitchen. Now, he always had his phone on him, always. And I remember that night, we're in the lounge, he's lying across me on the sofa, he's talking to the bump,
yeah,
having a chat,
yeah,
you know, hello, baby, it's daddy, all of that. And he said, can I borrow your phone?
Yeah.
And it's only since the event I've thought, well, actually, that was weird. Because I said, well, where's yours? And he goes, oh, it's in the kitchen. But now I look back and you think, well, was he putting a tracker? Was he putting Find My Phone? So therefore he knew
exactly
where I was, and hence why I went down Trinity Hill. He then follows me down Trinity Hill.
So that, going back to my point, that's the point I was trying to make. I don't think you could get more premeditated than that, from the night before doing these things with your phone,
yeah,
having the clothes, having two layers of gloves,
yeah,
padding out his clothes so he looks like somebody completely different, phoning you to say to you, where are you, come and meet me, all of this. I don't think you could get any more premeditated than that. How long did he get?
18 years to serve a minimum 12. And that was for attempted murder of me, attempted child destruction of our baby, grievous bodily harm of the two passers-by. Tony received quite a lot of facial injuries from being elbowed and that in the face and landing on the pavement. Johnny had got a cut in his hand where the knife had come back and cut through, and for carrying a knife in public. So he had five charges, to which he pleaded guilty to all of them. And he got sentenced for each one. And then they said, well, we'll run the sentences concurrently. So he's actually only got 18 years.
So a minimum of 12.
12. So potentially in 8 years' time, he'll be eligible for parole, which is beyond comprehension for me.
I've lost a word. The only word I could find is bullshit, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the only word I could find, like, you know what I mean? I'm kind of lost for words with that.
I think the thing is not long after, I think it was it the Walthamstow? There was a stabbing on a London underground train station, and it was an American guy, I believe, who was stabbed by somebody. It was classed as a terrorist attack. Mm. And he stabbed this guy. Luckily, thank God, the guy didn't have life-threatening injuries. And I listened to an interview with this American guy saying, I was really lucky. People of London helped, intervened, and I've walked away relatively not injured. Nothing life-changing. So I've, like, for people who don't know, I've lost a lot of use of my left hand, and I've had to have my little finger fused. I might have to have it amputated at some point because it's all coming out of socket. And I've got various other injuries. But this guy's saying, I haven't got anything lasting. The person who stabbed him, and this is just one person that he'd stabbed rather than trying to kill two, that person got 25 years because it's classed as a terrorist attack. And this is what gets to me. It's like, actually, the action Bobby did, the premeditation, the calculated nature, very cold, this whole walking, when I say he walked, you know, Johnny and Tony said that when he broke free of them and he came at me that second time, he walked.
It's not frenzy.
No.
That's not someone who's and it's a frenzy. Like, this is someone on a motive, like, you know what I mean?
He apparently rolled over on the pavement. He got up, he dusted himself down, and he picked up the knife, and he walked down the hill to where I was slumped on the pavement, walking, you know, just walking towards me. If someone's temporarily lost their mind, so part of his defence was that he'd temporarily lost his mind, and you'd expect he would run at me, okay? Maybe after the first guys had tackled him, he would have run off because he'd have thought, oh, this has all gone a bit wrong now. When the police arrived, it's always stuck with me, the fact the police said he threw the knife down. As soon as he saw the police, he threw the knife down. So he was compass mentis enough to know the police are here.
I'll go.
I better throw this knife down.
I think if you've lost your mind, and then even if you had lost your mind, and then you come to your senses at that moment, you would freeze. Because you'd be like, what have I just done? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But he turned, like, he went to go.
Some people say that you could turn and you could run or whatever, but yeah. When did you lose your mind? The night before when he took your phone to find out where he was?
And he's got the clothes,
you know,
I reckon.
When did you lose your mind? When you put the clothes in the car?
Yeah.
When you went to get the other pair of trainers that you'd never seen before?
2 days before he'd had the clothes.
You know what I mean? When did he lose your mind? You know what I mean? How is that a defence?
And even, he got interviewed by a police psychologist, first of all, because they have to interview to see if he's sane before the police interviewed him. When the police psychologist interviewed him, which I believe was the Saturday, so he got arrested Friday night, but they couldn't get a psychologist in to assess him. And they can't interview until he's been assessed. So Friday night he's in the cells, no questioning, and then the Saturday this psychologist goes in, and I've seen a lot of the transcripts of what was said in that interview with the psychologist, and he said things like, I've been thinking about it for a couple of weeks, I knew I shouldn't murder her, but I could see no other option, and I didn't know how I was going to do it because I'd never done it before. Which is always comforting to know that he hadn't done it before. That my sense of character judgment wasn't that horrific. But it's true, you have to laugh in the end, because it's like, I always thought I was good judge of character, and then I blooming get pregnant by someone who's a potential psychopath who tries to kill me 8 months. Like,
that's what's always amazed me about you, though. That's why I say, like, you're one of the strongest people I know, is that you do laugh about it, but I think that's just the way that you deal with it.
You have to.
You just crack some really terrible jokes sometimes. Really, really bad jokes.
But I know. Some of them I can't actually repeat, if we're honest.
No.
They should be broadcast.
Some really, really bad jokes. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah, I can't repeat some of them. But, it's one of those. It just came so out of the blue. And yet this man had planned it, as you say. And
12 years from, like, It's dumb, isn't it? I can't think of any more other words, like I said, apart from bullshit.
Yeah. And the hardest thing for me with the criminal justice system was he pleaded guilty, okay? So he pleaded guilty to these charges. And when they said he's pleaded guilty, it's like, I hope he bloody pleaded guilty. He got caught in the act by police officers with the knife in his hand. You know, he didn't stand much chance saying not guilty. And so he pleaded guilty. Now, I always remember when it came to them summarising the evidence. So we didn't have a trial. They just had to summarise the evidence on sentencing day. The Crown Prosecution had the barrister who put forwards about what he'd done. But they didn't dig really into the motive particularly. And I feel that if they'd looked more at what we've talked about, the fact that he was calm during the attack, the fact that he gave that knife up, you know, straight away, because actually he said he lost his mind, but actually when the police arrived, he was clearly very compos mentis. If they started to look at all the facts, they might have built up the actual sinister picture that I think it really was. And his sentence.
Think about it. It is what it is.
Yeah. And his sentence, I feel, would have been different. But it was almost like because he pleaded guilty, it ticked a box of he's pleaded guilty. So, and I don't feel enough effort, if I'm honest, was put on the prosecution case. Because basically, Bobby's family paid for a very high cost, top flight lawyer from London, defence lawyer. And I remember reading up about this woman when I got her name, and she even put on her own website about the fact that she specialises in contract killing, gangland killing. You know, that's the type of people she defended. And she did everything in the book to minimise his sentence. And they did it.
I mean, well, that's her job, so I'm not going to... I'm not going to slate her about that. For me, I don't see how you get leeway for pleading guilty to something that you're banged to rights for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but he got.
I can understand getting leeway. Hear me out. See if this makes sense to you. I can understand giving somebody leeway if it's a 50-50 case and they put their hands up.
Yeah.
Whereas they could have got off because it's 50-50. You know what I mean? I can understand. All right, then you come forward. All right, you're giving back the money. Blah blah blah. You earn something with that. Yeah. I don't think pleading guilty should get you anything when you're banged to rights.
Yeah.
You're banged to rights, isn't it? Saying, yeah, I done it, doesn't... Yeah, we know you done it, mate.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing.
I know you done it. So that don't mean nothing.
Because his sentence started at 30 years and they took a full third. They took the full tariff off for the fact that he pleaded guilty.
Oh, no. Seriously? Yeah. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, yeah. It dropped to 20.
Oh, my God. I didn't even know that.
Did
really?
You not even know how he went from 20 to 18? Because it gets better. It went from 20...
Hold on. It was 30.
Yeah.
And they took a third off, taking it down to 20 because he pleaded guilty for something that he was banged to rights for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to say that loud and clear. Just to make sure I was getting upset and angry about the right thing.
Yeah, you are.
Okay, tell me how it went from 20 to 18.
Because his defence lawyer got many people. He knew a lot of lawyers and accountants, people like that, and they all wrote these testimonials of what a good person he was, and because he was of good character, he got a further 2 years off his sentence. So you can imagine, I'm sat there with my family in the public gallery. I've been told not to respond, that I was going to hear things I didn't like, so I'm having to sit there and I'm just shaking my head in disbelief because I can't believe that this right honourable judge, who is a very sound mind of a judge, I'm sure, and it was a weird one, because when the judge summed up, he summed up and he started with the, you're a dangerous character, nobody saw this. He went to work that morning, they said, you went to work, you were calm, you were laughing, you were joking, you were on the phone to her, you know, you're a dangerous man because there was no warning sign, so we can never predict if you could ever do this again.
Yeah.
So I thought, this is it. We're going for a good sentence here. Yeah. It is actually at least going to be a sentence to justify it. And then it was like, all of a sudden, but, you know, you have pleaded guilty. And it's just when it was dropping, and I was just sat there thinking, how have we got to 18 years? And not even, if it was 18 years, you're going to serve 18 years. That'd be one thing. 18 years... serve a minimum of 12. I'm like, hang on, but my baby that survived, my daughter, which has got biological input clearly from him, 50% biology him. How am I going to keep her safe from him as a 13-year-old girl, potentially, when he comes out of prison?
Yeah.
What do I get as an answer? Well, there'll be a restraining order. Okay, so a piece of paper is going to stop him from sitting outside her secondary school then when she's coming out, because I'm really going to be able to let her come home from secondary school like I do with my older teenager, because they should do, because they've got to come home by themselves. I'm going to have to sit at that school gate to pick her up, because I can't trust that this piece of paper saying, well, he can't come near her.
He's not going to do it.
No, this is a man who tried to kill me. He is capable of anything. You know, and
that's a joke.
You can't say, well, he'll have a restraining order.
It's an absolute joke. Flip a restraining order.
It's a piece of paper, and that's not gonna stop him. It's not gonna stop him.
It's a joke. It's an absolute joke, man. But
yeah, so it's very, very hard to deal with about the sentence, I'll be honest.
So anyway, let me show them one more time, yeah, because it's a good read. It's gruesome, but it's a good read. There's stuff in it that we could talk about, but I want them to read the book still. So yeah, there is other stuff. Like, for example, you went to see him.
I did go to see him, yeah.
Yeah, but...
He's just ruined the ending of the book, by the way, for anyone listening. But, the final chapter, I go to see him.
Yeah, but you say that on the back anyway.
I don't know. It doesn't matter anyway. I'm joking. Seriously, I know I'm joking. I am joking. It does. That was a big moment.
We're going to leave that anyway. I'll let them read that. I'll let them read about that. Read it. Trust me. Read it. It's the funniest thing ever.
There are funny moments.
And it's like, also at the same time, you're always questioning. I remember reading it. I'm questioning, like, why would you want to go there? You know what I mean?
I remember you asking me that.
Yeah.
I had to face him.
When you explained it and in the book, you know, you explained it really well in the book, you know, and then it makes sense, you know what I mean? But honestly, it's a reading thing.
It was a big battle. It took me nearly a year to get in to see him.
Because they didn't want you to see
him. The prison did not want me to go in. Again, this is this whole thing in this country. I feel sometimes the perpetrators get protected more than the victim. They didn't want me to see him because... Well, it might make him feel a bit suicidal if I'd go and see him, and he might feel really bad if I go to see him, and they don't want him feeling bad. Anyway. And I was like, okay, but what about my own mental health? I need to face him because he left home as normal and never came back.
I
want to make him face me and talk to me.
Like, yeah.
But it was a whole day in quite a small room. I mean, I wasn't that much further than you and I are. He wasn't handcuffed. There were two prison guards with him. I had two probation officers with me, and I was right in the middle of HMP Birmingham, which is an experience in itself. I wasn't in the visitor's wing. I was actually in the prison. So it was an experience.
It's mad. Read the book, trust me.
And there is a funny bit of when I visit him, which I'll leave readers. I'll leave anyone reading the book to find that bit out. But I got my own little victory in there while I was there.
Okay. So anyway. So now... you do so much work. I really want to talk about that, like the charity work that you've done, some of the crazy things that you've done, by the way, for charity and stuff like that and things. So first I want to start off with is the air ambulance.
Yeah.
The work you do for the air ambulance. Did you know that it's nationwide, right? Any air ambulance gets no money from the government.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? They don't get no money, you know. All air ambulances are run by charity.
Charity, yeah. The only ones that get some subsidies are, I believe, the Welsh Air Ambulance gets some because they have to, because of the geography of the country, and Scotland, I think, because of having to get out to the island. So they get they do get some government support. Any air ambulance in England is 100% charity run, like 100% charity run. And every year, so Midlands Air Ambulance, they have a target of over 9 million that they have to raise. So they fly three helicopters currently, which have got dotted across the Midlands. They've got one in Shropshire and one in Worcester and one in Burton. And those three helicopters run in effect 24/7. They don't fly at night, but then they have a ground crew. They have a car that they can get medical expertise. Their ethos is, it's two things. It's one, get patients to hospital as fast as possible, which was important in my case. Yeah. The other thing is actually now taking emergency care to the side of the road. So you've got a doctor that's highly trained, you've got a critical care paramedic who is at the top of their game, and they're going out to incidences, and they are performing some incredible procedures literally at the side of the road.
Yeah.
You know, they've even had to open up people's chests to give heart massage. You know, it's doing things you just get in a military field, maybe. But that's the expertise that they are bringing, and they are saving lives, countless lives, with what they do, and obviously supported by the ambulance service, who are incredible with what they do.
Of course.
And it's them working together.
Yeah. That always amazed me when you first told me that, that they get no funding whatsoever, and it's all charity. It's crazy, you know. So some of the things that you've done for Midlands Air Ambulance and other air ambulances are marathons.
Yes. So I decided to set a challenge. I did it with a team, and we all said we were going to keep a treadmill and two bikes running continuously for 5 days. And then we were told that we couldn't go through the night with various reasons on security. We were doing it at the hospital that I was airlifted to. And so we said, right, we're going to do however many hours a day. And everyone had to sign up for their little slots of doing a stint on a bike or on a treadmill. Me, decided that I would walk on a treadmill for 7 hours non-stop every day. And the 7 hours, the significance was that my attack happened just after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I came out of theatre probably just after 10 o'clock that night. So for 7 hours, I'd really fought for my life. And so I said, I'm going to walk non-stop on this treadmill. So for 5 days, I walked 7 hours non-stop, and every single day I managed to walk a marathon, the length of a marathon. And
in a row, you know, this is 5 days.
And lots of energy bars, and I only needed to go to the toilet twice during that. No, obviously I went outside, but in the 7 hours, everyone said, do you stop to go to the toilet? It's always a fake. I don't know why this is fascinating with the toilets, but people do say, when you did this 7 hours, did you stop to go to the loo? You must have had loo breaks. And it was actually only 2 days. I had to stop just once on two separate days. And the other days I literally walked non-stop. And even went to the toilet, it was terrible pressure because people were looking at their clocks and they went, right, okay, you can go. And so I had to leg it down this corridor, try and say to anyone in the queue, please, can I just go because I'm being timed, go to the toilet quickly and run back. And there's nothing worse than someone timing you when you're on the toilet. It's just pressure you don't need in your life. You just don't need it.
Yeah, you don't need it.
Don't need it.
So, yeah, that was 7 hours a day, 5 days. That was just mad. I remember when you said you was going to do it. And I was like, sure. Like, you sure you don't want to do it every other day?
Yeah, you did say
and,
that. Yeah.
And stuff like that, you know, and you've done it. And even in the training, when you was training up to do that.
Oh, God, yeah.
You was in so much pain.
It was, I mean, I was. If you remember, I'd have to go. I'd be at the gym for hours on a treadmill, which is the dullest thing in the world. Mm. I remember, do you remember, I had to download. I was downloading things onto an iPad. Yeah. I was downloading, because, you know,
It's a long time.
It was hours that I would have to walk on the treadmill to try and build up this endurance. And I had to obviously speak to the gym manager that, look, I'm going to be on this treadmill for at least 4 hours. Are you going to be all right with that? And he was like, if that floats your boat, yeah, fine. And, you know, and I put up signs to say what I was doing and raise awareness of the air ambulance. Always had my air ambulance top on. But it was totally worth it. I love things like that. I love endurance. You know, I've got to plan my next crazy thing. I've got some ideas of what I'm going to do.
Yeah, because you've
next.
Done a few crazy things. What did you do before that?
Within 6 months of the attack, I mean, bearing in mind, I had to be in a wheelchair at first in the hospital after the attack because I couldn't walk any distance at all. So I was in this wheelchair. So I went from being in a wheelchair in critical care to less than 6 months after that, and bearing in mind I've had a child as well in that time, I was doing a wolf run, which is 10-kilometre obstacle course, extreme obstacle course in mud. And I did that within 6 months. And I remember my hand had just had surgery, so I was all bandaged up. And I was having to go over these obstacles. And luckily, I still get on, like I say, with my ex-husband, Ian. And Ian kindly said he'd do it with me. Because I thought, if someone's going to shove me from behind
over a wall,
has got my backside that close to their face, and it's not a nice, very uncompromising position. I thought, well, we've had two kids together. He was there in theatre. He was there in the labour ward. There's nothing he hasn't seen. He can be the man who shoves me over a wall. And he did. He did a great job. And we got round.
Okay, Wonder Woman. That's why I call you Wonder Woman. Yeah, it's a madness. And so what about the marathons? You used to do the marathon. Remember when you done the marathon in the fall?
Well, I did that run, yeah. I did it in a flight suit. So the air ambulance crew, you always see them. They've got these jumpsuits on.
Yeah.
And gosh, they're hot and they're heavy. And I had to wear long running trousers underneath and a T-shirt. And I'm running, and it wasn't a marathon. It was only 8.5 miles. Okay. But it was 8.5 mile in the heat. It was about 24, 25 degrees. They asked me to start that fun run off. So I had to be on the mic, first of all, to start them off. So I've got that added pressure. Then I joined them and ran it and took on loads of water and still felt dreadful when I finished. So 14 kilometre or whatever it was, 8.5 mile. And the hardest part of that run actually was the fact that it started at the bottom of Trinity Hill. So that run, weirdly, starts at the bottom of Trinity Hill. So I'm stood on a mic with Trinity Hill literally photographed. It's literally behind me. And then when we ran out of Sutton up the hill, we ran over the spot the air ambulance had come down. So then I've just talked, you know, people know what happened to me. I've just talked. I've got Trinity Hill. We're about to run over the spot that the aircraft landed on. So I've got all of this going on in my head. And tragically, that young lad I mentioned had only been killed 2 weeks before, right by where I was stood. So he's flat memorial, well, flower bank. So there's a lot going on that day, a lot. But I just focused on what I had to do and just got on with it.
Plus many other various things.
Yeah, I did the Abseil 240 foot Abseil with a pair of Wonder Woman pants on, very fetching, over leggings because nobody wants to see that sight coming down a building otherwise. Nobody does. And I did that zip wire. I've done all sorts of things, yeah.
It's amazing. I just want to tell you something else, you know, when it comes to the air ambulance and stuff like that, usually, like if you go into a petrol station, and they used to have them in restaurants. Remember, you used to go into shops and they'd ask you to put your change in a thing for thing. So what's happening now is, I remember I was doing a different charity event for somebody, and they were saying the problem that they find now is no one's using cash anymore.
Cards.
Everyone's paying contactless, so no one's got any change. So all those donations that people used to throw that. When someone was 99p, you throw that extra pound chain and £3 into the thing. They're not getting those donations anymore because everyone's using contactless, you know what I mean? That's something to bear in mind as well. Really,
yeah,
you know
I mean, charities are having to evolve while they're doing things now for that exact reason. I've done a lot of bucket collections for different charities and people go, oh, sorry, I've got no change on me. And you're like, got a note. And let's work this one up. But people, you know, charities are now having to think, instead of the charity boxes, as you say, that you put the coins in, that they're going to be contactless. But then that's obviously a cost to the charity because they've then got a piece of machinery. But it's the way the world is evolving. It is changing.
It's something to bear in mind still, you know what I mean? That if you want to give to these things, you have to look into it a bit more.
Yeah, but always give. Your local air ambulance, whoever they are, yeah, please, please just give because you don't know. It doesn't have to be as dramatic as myself, but unfortunately they are going out more and more to stabbings, and that's a key point as well. So Midlands Air Ambulance, who airlifted me, I think when the attack happened to me back in 2016, stabbings were about the seventh most common thing they went to, something like that. It's now the second, just after heart attacks. So that's how bad our knife crime problem has got, and there's a lot of young people whose lives will rely on something like an air ambulance
is, if an air ambulance comes out, it's not coming out for a nosebleed, really. So every time an air ambulance come out, it's a life
it's
or death
serious.
Situation.
Yeah, because it's all triaged, and then they decide. Yeah,
it's talking about the talking about knife crime and stuff like that. You started doing a lot on that avenue.
Yeah, so I've got a community interest company.
Yes.
So not quite a charity because there's a lot of paperwork and it takes a lot longer, and I just wanted to get going with it. So it's a not-for-profit company. I call it Inspire to Quit Blades.
Yeah.
I2QB, and it's all about me going speaking to young people, especially those at risk, and giving them the reality. And I do give them the really harsh reality. They see photos of my injuries. I talk about it. I'm not what they expect when I first stand there. You can see them looking at me like,
what's this woman?
What's this 40-something-year-old woman doing standing there? And they might think that afterwards, to be fair. But when they say, I'm the victim of a multiple stabbing, it totally stops them in their tracks and they listen. And what I want them, I feel with our younger generation, they need to really understand what the reality is. And I will take them through that. We talk about consequences, long-term problems. I talk about also consequences for perpetrators, because the person doing it, you know, it will change their life forever. And actually, they might not have gone out with that intention. So recently, it's been in the news about 14-year-olds in Telford who stabbed a boy.
Yeah.
And you think, well, did that 14-year-old, when they had that knife, did they think about it? I think there was a case a while back of a 12-year-old stabbing a 10-year-old. Awful. But the 12-year-old didn't fully understand, and he'd got into an argument somewhere, I think in some toilets or something, and because he got this knife on him, he pulled it and used it. But it was just, it wasn't a premeditated act, you know. The problem for kids is if they carry it, we all know what it's like. We lose our temper, you've got that heat of the moment, and somebody might go to punch someone. Back in the day, you and I growing up, there'd be punch-ups and stuff like that. Yeah. People would punch. Obviously not me. Not me.
You've already just said, back in the day,
yeah.
I used to knock people out. You just said that on camera, man. What are you talking about? You just said it.
No, I didn't.
Go on anyway.
I'm far too delicate a flower for that. And but that was the case, you know, and people didn't have... Okay, there might have been the odd person who had a knife, but... The fact is if you've got a kid who's got hormones and everything else, and they've lost their temper, lost their rage, some idiots really annoyed them, if they then go to punch, but they've got a blade, and this is what I say to them, you're then looking at attempted murder, you're looking at murder, and have you really thought about that? Because I don't believe that they have. They might carry it for what they feel is self-defense. It's never, ever self-defense. I'll put that out there now. It's not a self... It's always an offensive weapon. But, you know, I don't believe that half... The stabbings that happen are actually
of the consequences.
And these kids are ending up, and it breaks my heart for a perpetrator side as well as a victim side, that you could have a kid who's going then to a young offenders institute, or, you know, on the cusp of going to an adult prison, and that's it. Their life is labelled.
Yeah.
That's their life labelled,
yeah.
And they have to live with what they've done. But not only that, they're going to live with this for the rest of the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
They're always going to be that person.
So that's what you do. You bring the reality.
Yeah,
reality
on knife does. Let's talk about the consequences and do a bit of a positive empowerment.
What kind of age group is this that you're talking about?
Generally secondary school. But I can go right down from 8 and 9 year olds, which obviously I have to adjust what I say because the age group to be appropriate. And I've gone to talking to... young 20-year-olds, early 20s,
okay.
Sort of part of Prince's Trust programs. A majority of my work is secondary schools. I'm about to go and do some young offender unit work.
Yeah.
And it's about also empowering them and saying, do you know what? Even if your environment's really rubbish and everything's gone wrong around you and you can't control it, the thing you can control is you. You can control how you respond.
Yeah.
And you can have a choice. I could have had a choice. After my attack, I could have laid on that sofa, I could have felt sorry for myself, I could have not done anything. And everyone would have gone, Natalie, get it, you've had something really awful, Nat, you just lie there.
Yeah.
You lie there and cry, you feel sorry for yourself.
Nobody,
you hate the world if you want
you
to, because,
nobody, yeah.
Yeah, the world's dealt you a bad hand.
Yeah.
But I didn't, I made the choice to get up, get dressed, be mom, carry on. And that's what I say to the young people, I say, do you know what, you might be in an environment that you can't control. You know, you can't control what's happening at home. You can't control what's going on around you. But you can control you.
Amen.
And you use that power to go on and do something positive. I said the best way to stick two fingers up to people who don't believe in you is to go on and do something positive.
Yeah.
I said, that's it. I said, don't live or roll out their prophecy of you.
Yeah.
Go against it.
Yeah.
Go against it and be the person you should be. Sorry, I get really evangelical.
I love it though. And that's why I wanted you to do this more than that, because of that. And I love that. I love that you are still standing and you've chosen to do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you said to me it surprised you how much you get through to them and how much you enjoy doing
it. Yeah, I mean, when I first did it, it came about as chance. If you remember, I was asked by a pupil referral unit. So these were kids who'd been permanently excluded from mainstream education. They said to me, oh, Natty, will you come and talk about being a stab victim? And I was like, yeah, okay, and I put some stuff together. And I mean, I'd already getting into the whole professional speaking side, but that'd always been very corporate, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I have no idea. These are kids who've been excluded from mainstream education. They're going to be on the tougher side. They've probably been on the wrong side of the law at some point. I'm walking in, they're going to look me up and down. And they did. I'll be totally honest. I remember one lad being literally...
Yeah.
And he eyed me up and down. I still clearly remember him. Weirdly, I've seen him again recently, the same lad, because I've gone back to the same pupil referral unit. And I couldn't believe how much in that first... I did four sessions at this pupil referral unit, and the response was amazing. These kids wrote to me afterwards. They wrote me letters. They'd done poems. And it all got sent to me, and I read it, and I was like, okay, there's something here.
Yeah.
Did a few more, saw the same response. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because one girl who I spoke to, she'd just come out of social care, and I talked to these group of girls who were coming out into the world, scary time for them, social care, now having to go out, look after themselves. And I was talking to them, and this girl came up to me afterwards. She goes, you've really helped me. And I said, how have I helped you? And she said, because you've said it as it is. Nobody says it to us as it is. Everyone always tries to dress it something different or... but you've been straight with us. And I don't know whether it's that I give them the respect that I'm talking as a level, because I don't, you know, I just say it. I show my vulnerability. I say about how hard it was after the attack. So they see that vulnerable side. I talk about my trauma, my post-traumatic stress, the therapy. Something, though, just seems to click. And it is brilliant. And I get far more, and I shouldn't say this because it's going to ruin my corporate business, but I get far more out of talking to young people than I do talking to a group of business leaders.
As Madison said, you know, one derives more pleasure from giving than receiving, you know.
Yeah, so and just seeing how they are. And the lad that I said about who slumped in his chair when I worked in that pupil referral unit, I went back there a few weeks ago. The same lad is still in that unit. And he walked in and he came up and he went and he fist bumped me. He went, all right, miss. And I was like...
All right.
I was like, all right, how are you doing? Are you all right? Nice to see you. Hope you're behaving. And he was like, But then he was telling all the other lads who were in the session, mate, you got to listen to his stories. Like, and when I got to the bit where I revealed that it was my partner, that it was Bobby that did it, he was there literally grabbing his mates for going, you wait till this bit, you wait. I felt like he was there, like, properly building up the audience for me. He's like, ah, you wait till you. And then he's like, oh, that's the moment. So it's a real life story, and they can't argue with a real life story. They can have police officers go in. They can have community support officers go in. They can show them videos. They can show them stats. It doesn't have the same impact of me standing there as a victim saying,
I can understand why. I think if you've got a professional person in that, not saying that you're not professional, by the way.
Yeah, thanks for that.
But if you've got a professional person standing in front of you telling you these things, it still can come across as he's just doing his job or she's just doing their job and reading off a script. And it doesn't necessarily have that realness. Obviously, it's real, but it doesn't have that realness. Whereas there's you roll in with your Air Force, you know what I mean?
Hey, Air Force Ones, I have to do my...
Making sure you're not creasing.
Or clean side. Make sure I don't crease them.
And stuff like that.
My new Air Force Ones.
But yeah, you just tell it how it is as well. You've always been like that. You just tell it how it is, so it's very real to them. So
yeah. And a weird thing I once saw, I did a session, and it was a street first aid thing, and for people coming across people who've been stabbed. And they showed this video of this lad in London who got stabbed to death. And it's real CCTV footage, and this lad gets off and he's running, and part of it's reconstruction, and then part of it's actual film footage. And they show him being stabbed, and I was sat there in the room, and I literally had my head down, and I couldn't watch, and because it brought back a lot for me. I do struggle with seeing anything like that, and I felt sick watching it. You know, this is a young man who's having his life taken. He did die. And everyone else in the room is sort of sat there watching it like this. And so I'm watching the room thinking, we're watching something really awful here. I then stood up. They said, Natalie's here as a stab victim, and she's going to tell you about it. So I did my bit. There were people who had to leave the room because they were struggling with what I was saying, and I'm thinking, you just watched a film of someone being stabbed to death and none of you have really reacted emotionally.
Yeah,
I'm stood there, say a bit about my story, and I've got a couple of people leaving the room feeling a bit sick, feeling a bit, and, you know, sort of tears, and you think, that's the difference. Yeah. To me, you've just seen something awful on a film. I've just watched a young man die, and you're not affected. And I think because there's so much they see on social media,
desensitized, aren't you? You're completely. Like, you know, whether it's movies or whether mm-hmm. it's just headline on social media and stuff like that, you're desensitized to it, so it's yeah. not real. So it's a lot different. There's a big difference when you stand up in front of them and tell them the story.
Yeah, a screen versus having the actual person. Yeah. Big difference.
It's amazing work that you're doing, isn't it?
Thank you.
No, man, it really is, man. Every time I think about it, it brings a smile of joy and proudness. So, no, man, it's amazing.
Oh, thanks, Dad.
Anyway, I'm obviously too young to be your father. Anyway, you gave me... We were speaking on the phone, and you gave me a statistic.
Yeah.
I want to say it right. Maybe you should just say it. You said how often is a knife incident in yeah. the Midlands? What was that? Can you remember?
So, on average, last year, every single day, there were 10 offences involving a knife. Every single day in the West Midlands, on average, 10 offences with a knife. Every single week, yeah. it works out, on average, every single week, there is at least one attempted murder or murder involving a knife. Every week.
This is just in the West Midlands?
That's just West Midlands, yeah. That's West Midlands region. Because West Midlands region reported in their year, ending up to September last year, there was something like 63 attempted murders or murders, something like 21 murders and 42 attempted murders. So you add those up, 63 in a year, that's over one a week in West Midlands alone.
And 10 incidents a day.
10, yeah, because it's 3,610 or something, or 3,655. But I know it worked out that it was, on average, 10.
It's like 10.
Yeah, 10 offences involving a knife. Every day.
It's mad. It's just
and that shows how out of control. I mean, that was a 17% increase from the year before. That's, and the year before that, we were already at a bad place.
Yeah, of course.
So we're just still on this exponential curve, just chum. And it's got to stop. We have to deal this. We have to tackle with it. We have to look at what's going on. We have to think about mindset. We have to think about culture. I believe... Personally, we also need to look at supporting our young people first. I think the biggest issue we've got is we've got a lot of young people who are experiencing horrific trauma or witnessing horrific trauma younger in life. They're not getting supported. They end up getting excluded from school. School's obviously worried about their statistics, so it's easy to exclude. They might go to a pupil referral unit or they might end up on the street. They end up on the street, they have a gang. A gang offers them that security, offers them that vision of you can have whatever, and we perpetuate. We need to be supporting our younger people.
It's a lack of opportunity as well, isn't it? When you yeah. can't see a future for you going that way. The only way you can see yourself gaining what is normalized as success, i.e. having a lot of money. That's the only way you can see that you can obtain it. It's not... It's not the hard work ethic is not given to them. It's not portrayed to them. Opportunities are not there. So the easiest thing is this guy in the corner saying to you, "You come and work with me."
Yeah.
All you got to do is do this one act of violence, and you're in, and you're gonna earn X amount of money a week. You're gonna go and do it, aren't you?
And thing is, and then it's affecting others because then it's becoming a culture, and the biggest thing is and it gets me angry. You know, people go, "Oh, knife crime." They think young black male. And it's like, no,
yeah.
no. Let's take that out. For a start, number of females increasing dramatically carrying a knife. Black male? No, don't think so. Actually, it doesn't matter what age you are, what gender you are, or what the colour of your skin is.
Yeah.
There are more and more people carrying knives every single day. And there are children that you might think, oh, they're from a nice background.
Yeah.
And you will find out that that child has got a knife in their bag or they've got a knife in their coat. They might be carrying it for security, safety, because they want to be in with some crowd, whatever it is. But we have to stop labelling this, and we have to say this is a wide issue. Our young people are now feeling, for whatever reason, it's acceptable or it's the thing to do to carry
it's
knife.
Fashion,
and we have to stop that mindset.
Yeah.
And we have to stop labelling it, stop saying, well, it's just this, it's just that. No, it's not as simple as that. And that's why, so, you know, what I do is just one small piece in a puzzle that needs lots of other people doing their part. And I believe supporting our young people, giving them more hope, more direction, dealing with their trauma, if that's what they're... So many kids in pupil referral units that I talk to, you start, when they start talking to you about their stories, they've lived really tough lives.
Yeah.
Really tough. Things that kids should not have had to be put through. And you can almost see why they've almost ended up where they have. And yeah. It breaks my heart. Breaks my heart as a mum. Because I talk to them and all of a sudden you start to get this little chink and they start chatting and opening up. And I think if we could just be more of us to spend more time, maybe because we're a culture now that, this is a controversial thing maybe to say, but the parenting, there isn't sometimes enough effort put in at times, and it's easier when a kid's starting to be naughty to just write them off easier. Yeah. And I just feel there just needs to be more love, protection, support,
I know that's
understanding.
I think that's kind of real, to be honest. Yeah, with you.
And I feel we're in a society where we just, when things are hassle, it's easier to walk away.
Yeah,
we're a convenience society, aren't we? Definitely. Yeah, think about shopping.
It's a throwaway culture, isn't it? We've come up in this throwaway culture, and it's taken over everything.
Yeah.
At one point, when you spoke about convenience shopping or throwaway culture, you would only think about it in consumerism. Where you're not going to get that microwave fixed, you're going to just buy a new one.
Mm.
Or you're not going to get the washing machine fixed, you're just going to buy a new one. But I think that has now come into everything. Whereas you're just quick to walk, instead of fixing something, you're quick to walk away.
Yeah.
And I think you find that in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I think you find it in everything. The easiest option is to walk away.
Yeah. And this is the thing, and I think, you know, I'm not saying, I mean, some of the young people I've dealt with, I'm sure they're hard to get through, too hard to work with. I'm not saying that, but we need to be spending that time. We need to understand. If we can start to show more support, more hope, and then we can start to help make them feel that they've got a value and think about what's acceptable in the world they live in. I say to them, I believe life is tough enough for a teenager. I think it's even harder nowadays. Competition, everything. I said, yeah. I think it's so much harder. Your life is tough enough. Why are you making it tougher that you're perpetuating a society where if you step out the front door, if you look at someone the wrong way, they might pull a knife? You know, why are you wanting to grow this culture where knife crime is accepted, where carrying a knife is acceptable? Let's stop making life even worse, even tougher. Let's change that thought process. Yeah. Let's change that.
Yeah.
You know, it's. I find it heartbreaking. I think there's still so much to do, but we can't give up, and we can't just say, "Oh, it's overtaking us. Forget it." We've all got to play a part.
Definitely. And like you said, I think the labelling of it, just to give it the idea that it's just young black boys or it's just young boys or something like that. That's a get out clause.
Oh God.
Yeah. For people to turn around and say, "Well, I can't help that situation."
Yeah.
Then you know. We need to realise that it's everybody. It's all formers.
Well, I believe the recent stabbing that happened that I read on the news, actually two out of the three people arrested were female, 14-year-old female. Well, that doesn't fit with any stereotype, does it?
No,
so, you know, and this is the facts, you know, that it's... I had someone confide in me at a school I worked at, and she said, my son really shocked me the other day that he said, "Mum, do I need to carry a knife?" And he's a 9-year-old lad. And she's like, "No, of course you don't." You know, but the fact is that in Wolverhampton, I know that they are stopping kids as young as 8 and 9 and finding knives on them. Now, I think about 8 and 9-year-olds carrying knife, that's horrific. I believe the youngest that's been found with a knife was a 4-year-old at school, like in reception, a 4-year-old. Now, I'm not being funny. I don't trust my littlest one with a plastic knife at the moment.
Yeah.
But what is this child seeing, believing, hearing, whatever, to think, whether they're 4 or whether they're 8 or whether they're 9, what makes them think it's acceptable, it's I carry this knife?
I remember seeing a video on social media, you know, and what was in the video was this guy done a video and said that he took his daughter or his little sister to a party, mm. and he decided to search the kids, and he found these knives and stuff. But it was 2 weeks before that, about 2 weeks before that had come out, that actually happened to a friend of mine.
Okay.
Whereas they was he playing at the party. He was DJing at the party. It was a 16-year-old party, and there was rumblings that there's gonna be a fight. You know, some guys had turned up from who wasn't invited and stuff like that.
Gosh.
So the dad has turned the light on and stopped the party, and started searching all these boys in the party, and they're all carrying knives. I'm just like, I don't understand.
Gosh.
Obviously, I'm not from that time, but like, it's just a weird thing to me. Like, at 16, if I was going to a party, if I was going to a girl's 16th birthday party, I'm going to look for a girlfriend. I'm going to try and get a kiss. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about, yeah, I've got my belt, I've got my keys, I've got my knife.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's a sad state of affairs that is your priority at 16.
I'd only probably just been trying to smuggle a pack of silk cut cigarettes in, to be fair.
At the worst, I'm either going to that shop where that one shopkeeper will sell it to you, even though you know he's underage, or if he's not working, I'm standing outside the shop.
Or my bottle of
waiting for someone to come by. Like, listen, can you? I've got to get some cigarettes for my dad, but they won't serve me. Will you buy it for me? Do you know what I mean? That's the biggest thing that was on my mind. I know we live in different times and stuff like that, but come on, man. And that's part of my argument of keeping kids as kids, keeping children as children. They're growing up too fast for you to know anything else. You shouldn't know anything else at 16 than that. And that's my theory.
I mean, the 8 and 9 year olds being stocked with knives in the bag. I mean,
man. They're growing up too fast. People are letting them watch stuff. People are giving them phones. You're giving them access to all these things at the wrong age. They're too young to know these things.
And that is the thing, isn't it? I have this argument. I have this argument for my middle daughter about, I want this, mum, I want that. And you'd be like, okay, there is an age set on social, you know, like TikTok or whatever else, or Facebook, Instagram, whatever. And I said, the age is there because at the end of the day, yeah, a kid younger than that can watch it than 13 or whatever the age is. But they haven't got, even at 13, they've not got the emotional intelligence. But certainly, as you say, you've got young children watching it who have not got the emotional intelligence to separate what somebody play acting up on a video and, you know, somebody's pretending to be cool on a video. And actually, that's not the reality. But they haven't got the emotional intelligence to realise. They just take everything for real that they're seeing, and that must be how you should act, that must be how you behave, because they don't have, at that age, the ability to understand it. No, to understand it. And, you know, it's a big, you know, big thing of mine. I've got my middle daughter wanting to watch things that are too old for her, and I'm saying, but you don't understand it. And, oh, I do. And I said, no, because you take it for real. And you might think, say if you take the thing where she might watch some female YouTuber who looks like she's cool and she's doing this, that, the other. So she probably turns that camera off, and then she'll sit down in her joggers with her hair slouched all over, and her makeup doesn't look anything, you know, and she hasn't got that perfect life necessarily at all. But you believe that she's got this perfect life and that she's cool, and she'll chat back to her parents because that's what it sounds like on the thing, where she probably turns the camera off and goes, sorry, mom, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
Because she's portraying a life to you in front of that video camera.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I think there's so much of a distorted reality that kids watch on. I know we sound really old, probably our younger generation watches going, they're so old. But it's true. It's a distorted reality they're watching on social media. And they believe it to be true, and they try to emulate that cool
thing. I go as far as even bigger than social media. You know, I've always said that there is a connection between movies, your television program, games that you play, video games you play, and how you act. And people rubbish it. People turn around and say, there's no, everyone knows it's a movie. Everyone knows it's just a game. It's not. Those things affect you. For an example, everybody knows that as an adult, if you're listening to a certain kind of music, you drive faster, or you drive, you know, you listen to classical music, it's proven fact that you drive faster. If I listen to hip-hop, and I'm driving, you better get out of my way. I'm like that, you know what I mean?
So, I've seen you driving, I'll get out of the way.
Listen, yeah, you drive terrible, yeah. Your driving is worse than mine. I never forget the first time I saw you drive, I was like, wow. Are you in a rush or something like that? I've never seen 4x4 wheel spin. You was the first person, yeah, who wheel spin a four-wheel drive.
It was a Mitsubishi Outlander as well. I know, it was like, semi-electrical hybrid.
Exactly, it was like a hybrid. I'm like, what?
But yeah, people say there's no connection, and there is. There is. With my son, he used to, when he used to play Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
And his behaviour would completely change once he's been playing that game.
Yeah.
Once he's been playing that game, he'd get in trouble at school or something going on at home. I'd be like, where's that game?
Yeah.
Oh, he's got the game back. Yeah, and I'm like, well, you see, give me back the game. And I'll take the game away from him and his behaviour would change again. It would just... His temperament would change and he would just be calmer when he didn't play the game.
Yeah.
And that's a fact, you know what I mean? So, yeah, they're just being desensitised to this.
The desensitisation is huge. So I noticed it with my eldest. She's played thing, oh, gosh, the name, it's gone out of my head, but it's not Fortnite. It's the other one that's similar to that, but it was Overwatch. And so she played the Fortnite or Overwatch. Yeah, it's all games where they run around and they run around with guns or machetes or something else. And she's playing something, one of these sort of games where they're running around and they have to try and survive and all this. And she's got a headset on. And I was just leaning over to get something I could hit. And I'm watching what's on the screen. And I'm watching, you know, there's people being shot or there's machetes being used. And I know they're all like avatars or whatever that they've got. But I'm listening to what's going on the headset. And it was all her mates online, who all the lads that she's friends with who were all online. And they're all having a laugh and a joke with each other. And I'm thinking... But what's that doing to your brain? Because you're watching somebody slash someone with a machete, but at the same time you're all having a joke and you're all having a laugh and you run off and there's no consequence. And then you go off and someone gets shot or someone gets killed or maimed or whatever else. But they're all having a laugh because they're having a game together. And you think that's got to affect someone's brain, that the visual that they're seeing, which is horrible,
is not as serious as it is.
It's got to desensitize them because they're there having a laugh and they're getting on. And it's this whole no consequence because you've run off. And obviously with a computer game, you regenerate if you do get... And I think it has got to perpetuate. It's got to mold the brain in a certain way.
It does. It definitely does. I never forget another example years back. I always use my kids as an example, but... sorry, but I have to... Because that's my life, isn't it? So I'm talking about life examples.
Yeah.
I remember coming home from work. And I get home and there's chaos in the house. Yeah? So two girls are arguing with their mum. Yeah? And I'll come home from
work. Oh, I can't imagine that.
Yeah, right? So this is just kicking off. Everyone's arguing with everybody. And I'll come home and like, you know what? I don't even want to hear this. I'm not even interested. So I just walk straight past the kitchen and leave them to it. And I go into the front room. And EastEnders is on the television. You know what I'm going to say, innit? And on the television, yeah, it's two daughters and their mum arguing in the kitchen, yeah? I look at the telly and I'm like...
Hold on. Are they filming live from my house?
So then, and I was always against negative television them times in my house as well, you know what I mean? So I just lost it. I just flipped and just went sweet. Do you remember? And I was like, the same crap I'm telling you. Look at the television. Don't want this rubbish on in my house and blah, blah, blah. But that actually happened. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
Like what was going on live was on the television. I'm like, these things affect you.
It does affect you.
And you don't believe that.
We all learn of what's acceptable or what's part of the world by obviously what we see and we hear. And if you're seeing and hearing this stuff that's more violent or... You know, it will become part of your own world, even, you know, so it does affect, and people can't say that. I mean, there's an experiment, I believe, years ago, and I wish I was clever enough to quote what the experiment was, but there were these young kids, and there was this doll. People listening will probably know exactly what I'm talking about, but there's this it was this sort of blow up doll thing, sort of weird shaped thing, and the kids were watching. And when the mum or the adult went in, and she was nice to him, this mum was pretending to do tea parties. Yeah. When they let the kids into the room, the kids acted the same way.
Right.
Now they played it where the mum, the adult that they looked up to, this is years and years old, this is, and she starts hitting it and slapping it and stuff. It's only this sort of rocking, blow up rubber thing, and she's like hitting it, slapping it. When they let the kids in, the kids started acting violently to this same thing, because that's what they'd just watched.
Yeah.
And so they'd had that influence. And this is going back a long time, but it was the same thing. The influence of the behaviour they watched, they then mimicked when they went. So they were very much controlled by what they'd just seen. And when they saw this adult mother-type character going in being violent, they were then violent. And it's like, well, if kids, teenage, whatever, constantly watching things that are violent, or there's this lack of respect, and it's still, in the end, they're going to mimic that behaviour.
Definitely.
But I wish I was clever enough to say what the experiment was, but someone will know.
No, but definitely still, you know what I mean? But, I don't know. I think that's us still, you know, really and truly. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I think all what you're doing now is amazing. I applaud you. I really do. I'm so happy that it's taken off that way that. And I'm so happy that you found joy in talking to the kids as well.
Yeah.
And doing your stuff, you know. Natalie gets the old ragamuffin stamp. Three, two, the old ragamuffin, innit? That's real.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for doing this, yeah?
No, thank you.
I appreciate
you.
Love it so much, yeah? Give thanks. Come up and up.